contentious and important election, the court is hearing a case that could determine who wins a lot of elections in the future. On Tuesday of this week, the Supremes heard oral arguments in a case called Brnovich v. Democratic National Committee. And the ruling on this case, it could affect the power of the Voting Rights Act, which is a big deal. You are listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. And this week, we are talking about the threats to the Voting Rights Act. I'll let Mark lay out the specifics of that Supreme Court case.
This is a case that really goes to the heart of the Voting Rights Act, or what is left of the Voting Rights Act. And it involves two Arizona laws. The first law nullifies ballots that are cast outside of the voter's precinct.
So if you show up to the wrong precinct, even if you're in the right county and state, your vote doesn't count. That's the first law. The second part of this case concerns another law, which deals with an issue so partisan that it goes by two different names.
What Republicans call ballot harvesting and everybody else calls ballot collection. And this is a law that criminalizes the activity of helping to collect absentee ballots and drop them off with election officials. So Arizona has now criminalized that practice, that if you do that, even if it's not fraudulent, it is a felony. And both of these laws have been challenged in court under the Voting Rights Act. Both of these laws have a dramatically disproportionate impact on racial minorities. And the question for the Supreme Court is, first of all, you know, are these laws actually legal? And if they are, like, what is left of the Voting Rights Act?
I want to get into more of what is left of the Voting Rights Act in a bit, because a few years ago, a good chunk of it was kind of nullified. But before that, I want to talk about what the big arguments both sides are laying out to support their stances in this case in Arizona.
Yeah. So the Arizona Attorney General is basically leaning hard on preventing voter fraud. He's saying, look, we're really, really scared of voter fraud, even though we have not seen any in the state of Arizona. We think it could be out there, and we think it could affect us. So we have got to make sure that only the people who fill out their ballots are actually returning them. We think that harvesting ballots is going to lead to some kind of shenanigans. And also, we think that, you know, we assign voters precincts for a reason. We want to have an orderly election. And if they mess up, then that's just their fault. The other side says, okay, well, hold on a minute. There has not actually been fraud in Arizona. And you actually have allowed various forms of ballot collection for quite some time in Arizona, and it has not been exploited or abused. Instead, it has been a lifeline, especially for Hispanic communities and Native communities, where the residents do not have transportation to the polls. They might have difficulty getting to the post office. Mail collection is inconsistent. And so these groups have really relied on community activists going around doing the work and helping get these ballots to election officials. With the precinct question, the challengers here are saying, why does it even matter if somebody votes out of precinct? I mean, the whole idea of precincts, it's sort of artificial. Like, you know,
because you're still like in the same county or town.
You're still in the same county. You're still in the same state. You're getting the same ballot almost always. And so, like, what is the difference here? And I just want to add, there is a lot of evidence that for reasons that are very unclear, Arizona constantly shuffles around precinct assignments in counties that have lots of minority voters. They're constantly getting reassigned new precincts, and sometimes they're really far away. Sometimes people will have to drive past a precinct that's closer to them to get to the one they're assigned to. Whereas in those counties that are majority white, they really don't have this problem. So the challengers here are saying, look, we get that you want to run an orderly election, but there's really no point to this law. And moreover, it looks pretty suspicious that you're cracking down on out-of-precinct voting at the same time that you're making it really hard for racial minorities to even figure out what their precinct is.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. So this case is yet another case in front of the Supreme Court that raises some big questions about what the Voting Rights Act of 1965 can or can't do. Tell folks briefly what the Voting Rights Act of 65 is and what it does.
Yeah, an incredible landmark civil rights law that really broke the back of Jim Crow in the South. Because after Reconstruction, in theory, Black people had the right to vote. But in practice, Southern states passed all of these laws, you know, the literacy test, right, the grandfather clause, that pretended to be race neutral, but were obviously targeting Black people. So the Voting Rights Act came in, and in addition to banning those really blatant voter suppression measures, it required these Southern states to submit their election laws to the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., whenever they wanted to change them. So if you want to close a bunch of polls in Alabama, or you want to make it harder to register to vote in Georgia, under the
original... The feds have to okay it.
Yeah, the feds have to okay it and say, okay, this is not going to place a terrible burden on minority voters. And that worked really, really well, and it dramatically increased minority participation in elections, and Congress continually reauthorized it by huge, almost unanimous majorities.
And that's just half of the Voting Rights Act. There's another portion of this act that allows courts to look at the effects of some of these rules after the fact.
Yeah, that's right. So there's also a part of the law that says, okay, well, if the Justice Department can't or won't come in, federal courts also have the power to look at these voting restrictions and assess whether these voting restrictions have a disproportionate impact on minority voters. You know, if they end up making it harder for Black people to vote than for white people to vote, courts can block those laws. And crucially here, it's important to note, courts don't have to find evidence that these laws were motivated by racism. So courts don't have to find that a politician went to the floor of the legislature and said, I hate Black people and I don't want them to vote and that's why I wrote this bill. Instead, courts just have to figure out what the impact of the law is, what results the law has, and if those results are racist, the court has to block the law.
Yeah. And so we should point out here, these two big parts of the Voting Rights Act, half of that is gone. Preclearance was basically knocked out of the Voting Rights Act, what, 6 or 7 years ago?
Yeah, in 2013's Shelby County versus Holder, a 5-4 Supreme Court decision, the five conservative justices dismantled the preclearance requirement. They took away the Fed's power to block these laws before they took effect, and basically said this is a violation of states' rights. They talked about the equal dignity of states, and so we're really just left with the results test at this point in terms of having an effective tool.
Yeah, and so this results test, if the Supreme Court decides a certain way on this case in front of them now, Brnovich versus DNC, the results test could be gone as well?
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, there's two ways I think the court could approach this. It could just say, basically, the results test is gone, you know, we're just gutting the results test. Or it could pretend to uphold the results test, but make it impossible for anyone to actually prove that an election law has racist results. So they could do it openly, they could do it quietly, but either way, it would be pretty devastating for voting rights.
Mm. You know, something that happened after the Supreme Court basically knocked out preclearance, we saw a bunch of laws passed that had the effect of depressing turnout. What did those laws look like, and how widespread was that over the last 6 or 7 years?
Incredibly widespread. The biggest surge of voter suppression laws since the days of Jim Crow, since before the Voting Rights Act. So they were really draconian voter ID rules where you could vote with a gun permit but not a student ID. Slashes to early voting, often targeting counties and regions that have a majority of Black people or a majority of Latino residents. Hundreds and hundreds of poll closures followed in the immediate wake of Shelby County. The euphemism for this is consolidation. State lawmakers say, oh, we are consolidating the polls so that we have more efficient elections. And guess which communities see their polls consolidated.
Mm. Now, was there also, so like there was talk of like the purging of voter rolls a while back. Is that part of this too?
Yes,
and like
absolutely.
Other things like signature matching. There's a long list of this stuff, it seems.
Yes, all that stuff is similarly stuff that should have been blocked by preclearance, stuff that probably would have been blocked before Shelby County. But in the aftermath of that decision, the feds were powerless to stop it. And so all of these states became sort of laboratories for voter suppression. There was a race to the bottom among lawmakers to see who could suppress the most minority votes.
Yeah. You know, a lot of Republicans, a lot of anybody might say, well, this is not a race to the bottom. This is not racist. We want to prevent fraud. And these things we're talking about now, it is not a literacy test. It is not a grandfather clause. Define those two things from back in the day. Tell us how different it is from what's happening now or how similar.
Yeah, so a literacy test basically was an exam that was given almost exclusively to Black voters to prove that they could read and write before they cast a ballot. And these tests had ridiculous questions that are impossible to follow. You can actually Google them and read some of them. They are absurd. The whole point was to trip up Black people. Like, it was impossible to pass a literacy test. And so it just meant that if you were Black, you could not vote. A grandfather clause was similar, but maybe even more overt, because it meant if your grandfather was eligible to vote, then you are too. Of course, Black people's grandparents, especially when the VRA was passed, they were enslaved people, or they were crushed under the boot of Jim Crow. Of course they couldn't vote. I mean, if they tried, the KKK would literally murder them. So that's how these laws work. They were really effective in stopping voting. Obviously, a voter ID law is not the exact
same thing, right?
It's not that. Yeah. Let's be honest, let's be open about this. It's not as bad, but it's still pretty bad. Because if you look at the process of crafting these laws, for instance, in North Carolina, when North Carolina passed a voter ID law literally hours after the Shelby County decision came down, this law allowed IDs that were disproportionately held by white people, identification cards that were more likely to be held by people with higher socioeconomic status, people who had jobs maybe with the state government, with higher education, and then banned IDs that were more likely to be held by minorities. And the Fourth Circuit, looking at this slew of laws, said that the North Carolina had targeted Black people with almost surgical precision. So no, it's not a literacy test, but it's still really bad.
Yeah. You know, there's going to be a lot of folks hearing this conversation who say, well, must not be that bad, because I saw all those Black voters in Georgia, and Georgia went blue, and Donald Trump lost, and we saw record turnout in minority communities this last cycle. Must not be that bad.
Well, it is still bad. And
okay,
I think we have to measure the badness on a sliding scale. Is it as bad as the pre-Voting Rights Act days? No, of course not. But is it as good as we had it during the Voting Rights Act's reign, you know, when actually the feds could come in and protect voting rights? No, it's actually a lot worse. It's harder for Black people to vote today than it was in the 90s. We are moving backwards right now. And the fact that we saw so many Black people voting in places like Georgia, that is a testament to the Black community's ability to organize and overcome these huge hurdles that white people just don't face. It doesn't mean there's not a problem. It just means that Black communities were able and willing to come together and devote a huge amount of time and resources to making sure that they could actually cast a ballot.
Yeah. Do we know at all how the Supreme Court might actually rule on this? I was reading that Kavanaugh might surprise people. What's up with, like, where these justices will land?
So, of course, it's always hard to read the tea leaves. But I think we can conclude pretty clearly that the court's going to uphold both of Arizona's laws here. There's no sign that any of the conservatives thought these laws violated the Voting Rights Act. The big question is how far they will go when they write that decision. You know, there's all this evidence that the laws do have a disproportionate impact on racial minorities. So how do the conservatives write this opinion? Do they say, we see all of this evidence, but we don't care? Do they say, we see all of this evidence, but we balance it against the state's interests in protecting elections? Or do they say, you know, we don't even care about this evidence in the first place, and it shouldn't belong in court because the Voting Rights Act is illegitimate and illicit and none of it should exist anymore. So it sounds to me like they might try to find some kind of middle ground where they uphold these laws. They keep alive the idea that maybe some other voter suppression law might be too racist to pass muster, but they just leave that door open. And so they don't crush the Voting Rights Act this time. They just hobble it and give it a stay of execution.
Stay of execution. Wow. I have, and I don't know if this is a fully formed question, but I keep wondering how much all of this goes back to literally Reconstruction. and how in many ways, not just when it comes to who gets to vote, America never finished Reconstruction.
Yes, all of it. It all goes back to Reconstruction. There's simply no question that this was a huge debate during Reconstruction that just never got answered. Because before the Civil War, everyone agreed that the right to decide who can vote in an election was a right awarded to states, right? It was like, if Virginia doesn't want these people to vote, then Virginia gets to say they don't vote. After the Civil War, and in Congress, when Congress was debating the Reconstruction Amendment, there was a huge discussion and a lot of disputes about, well, should we sort of nationalize the right to vote? Should we make a new system where instead of states regulating who gets to vote, states have to step aside, let everybody participate, and give the federal government the power to protect that equal suffrage? And it just never really got answered. If you read the 14th and 15th Amendments, you won't find a clear answer to this question. It's not super clear whether the states or the federal government have the power to protect the right to vote. It's not clear exactly where the right to vote comes from. It's all very hazy. It's because the people who wrote these rules, you know, they were mortals. They were busy. They were confused. They were racist. They had all kinds of different opinions. They never settled on an answer, and we are still paying the price today.
Cue Shirley Bassey singing History Repeating.